accession number 18200, reel 4.
Dennis Maxted, reel 4.
Yes, he said, what's wrong? So I gave him my papers. He said, right, follow me. So I upped up the stairs and upped up another flight of stairs and into this room. And he said, right, he said, if you'd like to lay on that bed, he said, they'll be along in a minute to see you. So I laid on this bed, and in came these two officers. They were surgeon, you know, surgeon lieutenants. They said, well, what's wrong? So I told them what I'd done. They said, right, okay. So they went and got a light, just one light, quite a bright white light, shone it on my face. Said, right, what we're going to try and do, we're going to feel around you and see what's wrong, and then we'll try and straighten it. So I said, okay. So I'd already taken my trousers off. So they got hold of my leg, and they went, bang. And oh, cool, dear, the pain. I nearly passed out. They said, oh, well, that seems to have done it. Right, you put your trousers on, you can go. So I put my trousers on, and I upped all down the stairs, and down the stairs again. Got to the bottom, and the chief meets me. He said, why can't you bend that leg? I said, I just can't bend it. I said, I don't know what they've done, I said, but I just can't bend it. He said, oh, well, wait here, he said. So he goes up the stairs, he comes back again, he said, right, follow me. So I upped up the stairs again, back up into this room, white light, same two officers, and they did it again. So they said, right, you're free to go. So I put my trousers on, and up back down the stairs, and back down the stairs again, and the chief meets me. So he said, have they not done it then? I said, no. I said, I've just got terrible pain now. So he said, right, you wait here. So I waited there, at the bottom there. And he went back up the stairs again. And he come down about 10 minutes later. He said, right, follow me. I said, I can't get up there. I said, I've been up there twice. I said, my left. He said, come on. He said, I'll give you a hand. So he gives me a hand, and we finally get up there. We're met by a wren. And she said, would you like to come with me? So I went with her. And in this locker, well, I think there were 6 beds in there, 3 down each wall, you know, proper beds. And she said, right, she said, this is your bed. She said, what they're going to do is, so they're going to give you a shot in the arm, put you out, and they're going to put your leg right. So I said, oh, is that what they're going to do? She said, yeah. So I said, okay. So I got into bed, and they come along a little while later, give me a shot in the arm. I went off, and I come to sometime later, whenever it was, and I could bend my knee. All right. That was all right. Good. So I got dressed. They gave me dinner, I think it was. Give me something to eat. And I got a lift back to Medina. And from there, I went down to Westcliff. HMS Westcliff.
On the Isle of Wight?
No, from the Isle of Wight down to HMS Westcliff at Southend-on-Sea.
This is another shore base.
Yeah, another shore base, yeah. Another holding place, actually. And then from there, I had a prisoner. They asked me, well, they told me, I was going to take this chap. Apparently, he come from Manchester, and his gran had died, and he'd been brought up with his gran. His parents had abandoned him for some reason. And his gran, and she died, and he wanted to go to her funeral, and they wasn't going to let him go. But he was on the same draft as me, well, several of us actually, and we were going to KG5 docks at Glasgow, because we were going to catch the Duchess of Richmond, a liner, out to the east, out to Suez actually. So, but they didn't have an escort. They couldn't afford an escort because they ain't got one, because it was only a staging place. They didn't have them sort of people on, you know, around. So I had him. I had him handcuffed to me, so that when I get to Euston, I rang up the wife's company at Watford, Sun Engraving, and asked her to give her a message to say I'd be here, and I was catching the 11 o'clock from Euston for Glasgow, and could she come down to see me off? which she did. So I had to manacle him to the railings, and I had to stand by him, and the wife and I said our goodbyes with him next door, and I put him back on my wrist, and she went off, and we got on the train, and we got up to Glasgow the next morning, I don't know, 6 or 7 o'clock, and we were taken round to KG5 docks and picked up the Duchess of Richmond. There was about 100 Matlows in the ship, all taking passage somewhere. And the rest of them were RAF and Army, mostly RAF. So I reported to the duty officer, and he said, right, he said, we'll put your prisoner in the brig. He said, you come down with me. So I went down with him, and we put him in the ship's cells for a while. And when we left, and we got out into the Clyde, and he decided to let him up. And he let him up, and he made a dash for the side straight away, he did. He was a very determined bloke, he was. But of course, he could see that we was too far out, you know, he couldn't see the banks, really. And we were on our own, making good time, you know, down the Clyde. So he had to, I don't know what happened to him. I only saw him a couple of times. I mean, I thought he might have got a bit uptight about me taking him, but I was only acting under orders anyway. So, but it was one of those times when you found out about homosexuality. I mean, I didn't know much about it. It never showed itself in the services before that, to my mind. But on this Duchess of Richmond, there was all these RAF blokes, and there was also a few ENSA people, women, girls mostly, entertainers, you know. And they were down below in the cabins, and their Matlow's jobs was on either side along this long passage, either end of this long passage, where all these cabins were these girls in. Not only ENSA girls, but service girls as well. And us Matlows, it was their job to be on the ends, two on each end, to stop anybody from getting down there, you know, from being, it was out of bounds, really. And that was our job for the, I don't know what it took, about a week, I think, to get across there. And also, they had all these hammocks were issued to the troops to sleep in, the army people. And of course, they had got no conception of a hammock. They didn't know how to rig them or sling them or whatever, so we spent a lot of time doing that. But this there was a bit of a commotion down aft on the quarterdeck one day when we were up there, and we looked round to see what it was, and there was this 40 gallon drum full of thick oil, and there was this little chap, and it turned out that he was a homosexual, and they couldn't tar and feather him because there was no tar and no feathers, but they could show their displeasure, I suppose, by sticking him in this 40 gallons of crude oil. Yeah, he didn't have smell. I think he must have smelled forever afterwards.
Was he RAF?
RAF, yeah, he's a little RAF chap, yeah. And so that was the first time I'd ever seen homosexuality, if you like, displayed in a way.
What exactly had he done?
I've no idea what he did. I mean, we didn't ask, because it was, you know, I mean, just one of those things that was going on. And I caught my dose of crabs on that boat. I'd always slept in my own blankets, because you have your own hammock, don't you, you know? But now, because all that stuff is stowed down below, so you haven't got your own hammock. You've got, what you've got is issue blankets and one of their hammocks. So I decided to undress one night, because I'd been sleeping in me clothes. And when I got to HMS Saunders, which was at Cabret on the Bitter Lakes, I felt all itchy, you know. So I went over to the sick bay and saw the sick bay tiffy. He said, yeah, you got crabs, he says. So you want to go over and shave off, he said, and come back here and I'll give you some cream and that to put on it, which was that violet stuff, violet. Something rather it was called, or something of violet, unction of violet or something. Anyway, That's what I did. That was the first and only time I've ever had crabs, or even, you know, experienced it. I heard about it, but never actually experienced it until that time. And then when I was in under canvas at HMS Saunders, I had another attack of my right leg, knee. So I hopped over to the sick bay, which was very difficult because it was all sand. And the sick bay tiffy over there, he said, "Have you had trouble before?" I said, "Yeah," and I told him. He said, "Right." He said, "I'll get the man to see you," which he did, which was a lieutenant commander. And he said, "Well, hang around here," he said, "and I'll see if I can get you into hospital." And sure enough, a couple of hours later, there was a truck pulled up outside the sick bay, and it was this Greek Cypriot sailor. He said, "I've got to take you to the 19th General at Geneva," he said, "they're going to have a look at you there, apparently." So I took me papers, and away we went. We went down to Geneva, and I was in there. I got in there, and this Canadian major, army chap, he came around, and he said, "They're going to put you out tomorrow." He said, "See what we can do, see what's wrong." "Is that all right?" I said, "Yeah, it's okay." He said, "Good." So the next day, they took me down to the theatre and put me out. When I come back, I was back in my own bed. And he came in that evening and he said, "Yeah," he said, "I'm going to take, you've got a cartilage." He said, "It's gone." So he said, "I'm going to have to take it out." So I said, "Right." So he said, "I'm going to do that on Thursday, 2 o'clock in the afternoon." I said, "Okay." In the next bed to me was a Pakistani chap. He was a merchant seaman, and he got a scar all down, it was a shrapnel scar all down here, about 15 or 16 inches long
on his thigh,
yeah. And he was supposed to be taking exercise, and he said he didn't understand, you know, the nurses there are all two pippers, and so they went away. And well, that evening, matron come round, little tiny lady. And she spoke to him in five dialects. And you could see he understood. He understood. So she told him in uncertain terms that no way was he going to be messing her nurses about. He was going to take exercise. If he wasn't going to take exercise, she would see to it that so-and-so and whatever was going to happen to him. Because the exercise for him and for me later on was two sandbags. They weigh 3.5 pound each. And you had one on your ankle, and all you had to do was this. Just raise and lower your leg like this, with 3.5 pound on. And after a while, you put the other one on, so you got 7 pounds on. And he had to do the same. And he did it as well. Mind you, his eyes went, you could see the whites of his eyes. But he did it. But I was interested in that ward, because there was a chap from the Midlands somewhere who was in the tank regiment. And they'd been on night exercises in the desert somewhere. And they stopped their tank and got out to exercise, you know, walk around and whatever, and have a cigarette and that. And he walked over the edge of a cliff. So he was in plaster from here to here.
And from neck to groin.
Yeah, from neck to groin, yeah. And when the sand fleas used to get inside, he used to bang like Tarzan on the front. And there was a chap in there, he had been a London bus driver. I forget the route he was on, but I think it went to Chiswick, his bus. And in those days, there used to be them paperback called Cherry Books, I think they were called. And he said, he was reading one of these things. He said, "Yeah, listen to this." He said, "I'm reading about myself." And there was a passage in this book that was describing this driver and whatnot, you know. And he was reading about himself in this book, although it was like fiction, as it were. There was a chap in there who fell out of a Spitfire, or no, it was a Hurricane, I think, he fell out of. They were a group of Japanese aircraft, I think it was, that had jumped on them while the aircraft, but their aircraft was still on the ground. Anyway, they made a run for it and managed to take off. And he hadn't strapped himself in and he hadn't pulled his canopy over. And as the aircraft rolled over, he fell out. And he fell a couple of hundred feet into the tops of the trees. So he was in plaster all over the place. He had his arms up in the air like this and his body and his legs. He was in a bit of a state, really. But he was quite cheerful about it. He was a sergeant pilot. Yeah, and there was a chap in there from... But the recreation hut there had a dartboard in it and a piano. The dartboard was worn out because the camp was looked after by West Africans and they used to throw darts like they would a spear. So it was, and the piano was worn out with about one octave where it was their one of their chants and they'd been banging on these notes as one of their chants and worn it out. But also in there was a chap, he must have been in there for quite a while, because he was building a model about 2 foot, 2 foot 6 long of the Queen Mary in matches, spent matches. He used to go around the wards and everybody used to save all their matches so that he could use them in building this. I don't know whether he ever finished it or not, I don't know. But at the other end of ours, these huts, they were like these Nissen huts, weren't they? Quonsets or whatever you like to call them, was Italian prisoners of war. And the ones that were ill. And outside the hospital was a compound of German prisoners of war. And they used to send in 2 every morning to pick up medical supplies for their camp. And they used to have one of these painter's barrows, you remember the old painter's barrow with a big handle and big wheels on it and about so big and narrow sides. And you very often had the man's name on it. Well, they had one of them and they used to come in. And they were really stroppy, these two, because they used to whistle the horse whistle as they came in the camp, you know, every morning. It never altered. Yeah, they were a couple of stroppy ones. And the chap I used to go out with, he was a dispatch rider. He came from Scotland, and he'd just grown his hair. And it was like a day-old chick. He was fair-haired, and his hair was just like a day-old chick's, you know, all over his head. It was a fluffy, and I asked him how he got that. He said, I was doing this Don Arbit, he said, on my Norton motorcycle. He said, and there was these 2 Arabs weaving all over the road, he said, drunk as you like, and I went to avoid them. He said, and I shot off the road and hit a telegraph pole, and it split at the base, you know, the telegraph pole split in half, and as it was jumping about on the wires, so it fractured his skull and they had to take all his hair off to have a look and do his repairs, you know, he had scars and that, and it was all just growing because I used to go into Ismailia with him for an afternoon tea at the Copper Kettle. I got his photograph out the other day, had a look at it, and then from there I went, that was in January. I had my operation in early January, and I was in hospital until May. And then I got back to Saunders, and I was drafted to an LCT Mark 3, 7-8 something or other it was. I forget what it was, but I had this draft, and then they got their signalman back, so they didn't want me, so I went back to Saunders. And then I got a draft to LCT 1066. And we were then, we went from there down through the Red Sea into the Indian Ocean. And we were towed behind a merchant ship, one on each side, to Port Swettenham. And then I got drafted. No. Yeah, Port Swettenham, because Cochin. We went to Cochin because when I was at Cochin, I got drafted from 1066 to 1309. LCT 1309, and I stayed with her for quite a while, I think. And
at Kuching.
Yeah. No, from there. It was at Cochin because we went round to Trinco, from Trinco down to Port Swetnam, Port Dickson. And when we got to Swetnam, Port Swetnam, Air Skipper, it was a two ringer on 1309. We were told to anchor at such and such a spot. So he said, right. So he had him down aft, ready to slip the kedge because you anchored with your kedge. And we had our Mulocks on, these big steel ramp things that go over to, so you could get tanks on and off quite easy. We were loaded with tanks. We had four on. We had the 11th Indian. We had 11th Indian, a tank regiment of the 11th. I think it was the 11th Indians. Because in charge of them was a chap called Pierce, who'd been a Scotland Yard detective at some stage. He was in charge of them, Lieutenant Pierce. And air skipper said, slip, and eyeballs out, slip. And they let the old stopper go, and over the side she went. And right in front of us was the Monarch of Bermuda trooper. And before our kedge could take up, we'd swept alongside the Monarch of Bermuda and ripped a hole in her, about 9 or 10 feet long, like a big tin opener, with our Mulocks had done that. So he was on a fizzer. He thought the crew had done it on purpose, and he was going to be interviewed. And he was a real terrible bloke, he was. And we went from there down to Dickson, and from there we went to Singapore. We did a bit of we had air bottom scraped in Singapore, because I've got photographs of that. Because the Japs had now surrendered. We'd had air victory parade, old man Batten had, and all that sort of thing. Got photographs of all that. And then we did the old ship to shore business from the Liberty ships, backwards and forwards, things like flour and things that they were all totally short of, you know, that sort of thing. And then we went out to we were sent out to Batavia to go and pick up the Rapwe people, the women and kids from all around, you know, and pick up their political prisoners and take the Japanese out and do all that stuff, which we did. Went up to Semarang and all around the islands, picking up women and kids, taking them back down to Batavia, going out. And then around the islands, picking up all the old political prisoners that were the civilians, bringing them back to Batavia, and taking the Japanese out, and keeping them on islands and whatnot, you know, keeping them separated. Because old mate Batten didn't want the Dutch in there for some reason. He didn't want the Dutch back. And after we'd done that for some months, we went back to Singapore. And when we got back to Singapore, we were told to take everything off of aircraft, Air 1309, because she was going somewhere else. And we were transferring to LCH 248, which we did. We transferred it to LCH 248.
LCH?
Yeah, Landing Craft Headquarters. American. And she'd had the press aboard. They had press men aboard, you know, reporters and whatnot. And they'd been put ashore in Singapore.
This is 1946, is it?
1945. It could have been 1946, yeah.
Never mind.
And then we had to take it up to Manila. Back to the Americans for lease land. They'd been on lease land, you see. So we all had to go up there. Loads of us took them up there to Manila. And we were up there a week. But they wouldn't allow us ashore. We couldn't go ashore in Manila. But they used to entertain us. Picture shows used to take us around to their ships and just pictures and things, you know. And after a week, our skipper, he said he'd heard that we could get back to Singapore. And there was two ships in harbour at the time that was going back to Singapore, HMS Cavalier and HMS Cavendish. So he asked if we could take passage. They said, yeah. So we took passage in Cavalier from Manila back to Singapore. They said, if you can get back to Singapore by May the 5th, I think it was, you can go home. The Esperance Bay is sailing for Blighty. So we did. We got back by the 5th of May, and we sailed on the 6th on the Esperance Bay. And we touched down at Tilbury on the 6th of June, 1946. And from there, we went back up to Scotland, Roseneath, where I got demobbed. We was up there for a week, went through all the demob routine. And then I caught a train back to Guildford, and I got my demob suit and all the other things that you got when you got demobbed at Guildford. And then they gave me a ticket to Reading. I've got a ticket back to Reading, which went very far. And that was over. That was on June the 15th, 1946.